Good morning, everyone. Happy Sunday. Hope you've had a chance to get out there and enjoy all these great resources that we have. With Captain Scott Null, Captain Dean Thomas, and Captain Caleb McCumber, I'm John Lopez, and this is the Bite Me Fishing Show. Also, all things outdoors, of course. Let's get into it. We've had some rain, man. It's been a lot of rain, but we're talking about the quote-unquote perfect storm for Gulf Coast fishing and, of course, water table. So, Dean, you've mentioned this once or twice, but since we're on the topic, what would be the perfect tropical storm or hurricane for the Texas Gulf Coast? Because there is such a thing. You know,
careful now. I got race carded on that last week.
I saw you.
there's a desert down there. On your regular show. Yeah, your regular show, you do y'all have the race card thing. And then very next day, the guys that were getting on my boat were listening to it. And I got race carded for trying to send a storm into Mexico.
Race car.
The perfect scenario for the Texas coast is that it goes into Mexico or Louisiana.
See, there you go.
So I say that all the time. What is unfortunate for our neighbors in the Gulf is fortunate for us for fishing. So it pushes in a nice pulse of clean water from the Gulf, cooler water, raises the tide up, floods those lakes and those shorelines, and just stirs up the action without all of the drama. And you know, Scott was talking about Alicia. Harvey did the same thing. Harvey popped up right off the coast. As I'm sitting here boarding up the windows, I'm like, in total denial. It's like, this thing ain't doing nothing. But the whole time I'm screwing boards on the windows. And then in short 24 hours, look what that thing turned into. It's definitely time to be on the lookout. But it does wonders for the fishing, man. It pushes schools of reds that are hanging around those jetties onto the flats. And where we're at, we're right behind the pass. I mean, Redfish Bay is 3 miles from the Gulf of Mexico to one of the biggest passes on the coast. So it pushes a massive amount of water in. It changes every scenario dramatically. And it turns fishing on. Some of the best days of summer are on the storm surge.
One of the best days I've ever had catching trout was after a hurricane. I want to say it was early 90s. I forget which hurricane it was. I mean, just monster trout swimming between your legs. We were wade fishing. My buddies went out the day before and did even better. But that does remind me, Scott, I did get one question about hurricanes, and it wasn't necessarily about this one. It was just kind of in general. They were talking about like how what Dean referenced right there, you know, the higher tides, and we've called it like a wash. You know, it's a big wash of the whole coastline. And the question was very simple. What does a wash do?
Well, it energizes everything. We're sitting here and it's salty as hell. We hadn't had any rain anywhere on the coast. You know, Dean got 7 inches the other day. I don't know how the hell that happened, but that was about three months ago.
That's a distant memory now.
yeah. That was more than I have. But, we hadn't had any fresh water coming down the river to speak of. And so it's getting awful salty out there. If you get a storm, you get a lot of rain with it. And that, you know, that helps our salinity, you know, gets us a little more back to normal. But the biggest thing is that push of water, just energizing the bays. It shoves just a ton of Gulf water up into the bays. The storms also, as they churn across the Gulf, they well up that deeper water, and the deeper water's cooler, and so that helps cool off the whole entire Gulf. And with the higher tides being pushed in with that, you know, our water temperatures are going to moderate. Then you got the cloud cover that also helps everything about it. You got a lot of wind, you get a lot of oxygen in with the wind and making the waves, and the whole thing is good for the fishery in general. It's just not good for wherever it actually hits. You know, I mean, that's the hard part. That's why I said last week, you know, going to King Ranch, knock some cows over or something, and we'll all be good.
Yeah. Man, those folks, the folks up in the hill country are, you know, desperate for some tropical weather.
Oh,
And you know, you can have a tropical wave, you can have a tropical storm. There's so much varieties. You know, everybody fears the mass destruction of the wind, but the Central Texas lakes and rivers are beyond desperate right now. It's crazy. And whenever they come in through from Corpus Christi south is when they put all of the rain through San Antonio, through Kerrville, through the hill country. And I mean, those guys are praying for that stuff right now. So
I'm telling you, man,
a picture of the Medina River the other day that is absolutely dry right now up in the upper end of the hills. So what is terrible for others, I mean, and if it doesn't come with the 100 mile an hour winds, the earth could absorb 20 inches of rain through those areas right now. And it would be tough for a couple days, but in the grand scheme of things, that is what brings life to that part of the world at this time of year.
You know, Scott, the other thing that really just kind of occurred to me right now is I just remember the dunes playing such a big role back in the day when there were more sand dunes. And I know there are areas that still have them, but that seems to be where the real damage comes now. But as long as the rain, as Dean was saying, you know, is sustained and strong and gets to the right spot, it's good. But man, I wish we had some more sand dunes in some of these areas that used to.
Yeah, the worst part of the whole thing is the storm surge. You know, the winds are bad, but they're over a very, very small area. The storm surge is what gets everybody. All the flooding and pushes buildings over, which, you know, it pushes the weak buildings over, and then that pushes those into
my
the
Dean's place
buildings and tears those up. So
I'm still amazed at that house was from 1920 or something.
1900 turn of the century. 1900
standing right there on Commercial where it needs to be.
Well, it was barely standing after
Harvey. Yeah, it was limping.
It was limping.
we gutted that thing afterwards.
Yep. Scott came down here with the dump trailer and we stripped this thing down. But yeah, I mean, it blew out every window. It blew it off its foundation. The whole house was leaning over sideways, and put cables and winches in it and pulled it back into shape. And I looked at it for weeks. I could have bulldozed it and pushed it to the street, just like many other houses. It would have cost absolutely nothing because the trucks were coming down the road, and you could squash your entire house, push it to the street, and they would pick it up and it was gone. But there's so much history in this place. I looked at it, thought about it, and with a lot of help from friends and many generous people that came out, we put this thing back together and still stands to this day.
Yeah, it's probably stronger than ever. Yeah, no question.
Yep, we're ready for another one.
Well, I don't know if we're ready for another one like that, but we're ready for some rain. Hey, let's get to this. This is a creation of just a conglomeration of questions and topics that I've gotten that I never really could get to, so I decided to turn it into a game here. I have a hunch that we're actually going to disagree on some of these. But I'm interested in what Scott and Dean have to say. Fact or fiction? I'm going to tell you guys, and we'll go back and forth with who starts, and I hope I can remember who starts and who doesn't, because I forgot last time. So we'll start with Scott. I'm going to say the myth or truth, and you tell me if it's fact or fiction. Number one, some honey holes always produce fish.
That's got to be fiction because there's so many conditions involved. There's places that are going to be better than others on most days. You know, I have a few of those that I know, but none of them are going to always produce. I don't think there's any place other than my catfish pond out here.
My catfish, of course. Pond,
I mean,
you know what's funny about that is
that is a honey hole.
That is honey. How big are they now?
About 5 or 6 pounds. Catfish.
What?
5 or 6 pounds. Yeah.
Man, oh, they're huge. Get dinner anytime you want. Anytime you want. So, Dean, the interesting thing about that one, I want to get your thoughts on some honey holes always produce, is we're always talking to people, and you know, that love our what we love here, fishing, And they all, it always kind of turns up, man, every time I go to blah, 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 I just kill them. And there's probably something to that, but there's always just a couple of little factors in there that, that can't make that just a sweeping statement, right?
Nothing is guaranteed out there unless you're in Scott's Pond where you got them kind of pinned up. The problem out there on the bay is there's no fences to keep them pinned in for to be there tomorrow. But I go straight to the honey hole every morning, and none of that is always etched in stone for
that's
me.
That's why you go to plan B and C and D.
And yes, yeah. And people, yeah, that's what they ask me later in the day, like, oh, we're going to the best spot now. It's like, no, we maybe. Went there. We went maybe. There 4 hours ago.
Yeah. We'll see.
But we'll yeah. Try. I mean, you have your spot that you have your confidence in, or you know they were there last time, or you know it's the time of year when they gather in those places. But honey hole is, it's that, that the fact that they're always there, that's fiction. It just, it if I wish there was a place that I could go to every day and just wear them out. But, a lot of variables. It's like Scott said, the wind's going to blow you out of there one day. The tide's going to change and something's going to be different tomorrow.
No doubt. All right. Let's get to some fact or fiction in fishing with the fellas, including can you catch fish on a slack tide? That's next here on Sports Radio 610. Welcome back. All right, Dean, you're first on this one. You cannot catch as many fish on a slack tide.
That's fiction, man. You can catch them on a slack tide. That changes throughout the year.
As I many?
Mean, I've, those rules are all meant to be broken out there. So during the fall and the spring, whenever the water temperature is just perfect, you know, where fish are feeding more, they tend to be more active. On slack tide is a lot easier. You're going to get fish to bite throughout the day. In between the majors and the minors, you can expect to be more productive. During the heat of summer, the dead of winter, the current is a big factor. Those things do help.
Absolutely. It's the slack tide means nothing if you got wind blowing. And that's going to create its own tide. So, right. Yeah, you can catch plenty of fish on slack tide if you know what you're doing and you fish the winds and where the wind's going to blow and where the fish might be stacked up a little bit.
The color of your line matters, Scott.
That's another fiction one. I've seen people fishing with the pink line. I sold the pink line. I was the sales rep for fins when that came out. I don't think it really matters too much. As long as you're using a leader in that real super clear water, it doesn't matter. You Galveston folks and Louisiana people, I can tell you it doesn't matter over there. Just tie straight to your lure. Don't worry about that leader. Don't worry about any of it, except maybe in the winter time when it does get a little clearer in Galveston. But the further south you go, it matters a little bit if you were tying directly to your lure. And didn't have a leader on, it might bother them just a little bit, but overall, no, I don't think so.
It's what you like. Like I've always used the moss green line. And the other day I bought the coolest line just cause I thought it was cool as all get out, Dean. It was dark blue, then light blue, then a lighter blue and then white. And I'm like, ooh, baby, that's perfect. And I'm like, what am I doing? What am I doing? It just looks cool on the reel.
I got that on my Kingfish rigs. It's it's multicolored.
Yeah, I love it.
But I'm going with line color doesn't matter, especially with a leader. The aggressive nature of our fish overrides those things. But also, like Scott, I hate to agree with Scott so much, but here I go. if you're tying the braid directly to the lure, which that's a mistake too. So there's been a huge chat conversation going on about leader, braid straight to the lure. If you're tying the braid straight to the lure, you may or may not have issues. That's a tough call. But with a leader, it's going to absolutely eliminate that issue. They're not going to see it. To fish without a leader, to me, makes no sense at all. The fluorocarbon has so many advantages. It's stiffer. It's straight. It's with a loop knot. It's not going to affect the action of your lure. It's an insurance policy that they can't bite through if it goes deep. So fishing with a fluorocarbon leader, it's never going to matter what color the line is.
And you're talking to a guy that for the vast majority of my fishing life, I would tie my lures directly onto the line. But I've always fished in East Matagorda, Trinity, Sabine, you know, so it really didn't matter as much. Now that I'm down in some clearer water, I'm going to have to start tying those loop knots and get some leader on there.
But don't you feel that you get a few more tangles where your lure...
I don't. I get that. My theory, and Scott's heard me talk about this before, I just want the fewest things possible between me and the lure, the fewest potential hiccups. You know, mine's more mechanical than anything. But I will say, now that I'm in clearer water and I've been thinking about it, and you guys have kind of reinforced it there, of just tying more of a fluorocarbon that floats, you know, onto the lure, and then go from that to the line, you know.
And not to get too far off of your little game here, which is fun, but I use 10-pound braid for the ability to cast. So
yeah,
the weakness is the knot. The weakest link in the chain is the knot. So if you're tying really light braid to the lure, or if that lure goes deep in a fish's mouth, you got a much greater chance of getting that line cut off.
Right.
So that is a lot of variables in that question.
All right. Well, here's one for you, Dean. You're starting. I think I've remembered every rotation here correctly so far. Big bait, big fish.
True.
Yo, that's fact.
Fact.
You like that?
I believe that the bigger offering will catch you a bigger fish and eliminate some of the smaller ones.
Scott?
Biggest trout came on a little fly tail. My second biggest trout came on a little bitty fly. So, you can catch big fish on little stuff if you get in the right situation. A Kelly Wiggler shrimp tail is what I caught my biggest trout on.
I caught mine on a biggest trout. This one right above my head. 3.5-inch plastic. Pink on chartreuse. Yeah. 3.5-inch. But – to be fair, Scott, I think the odds are, maybe not. Hell, I don't know. I've caught a bunch of big trout on just, you know, small plastics. But maybe the odds are, if there's big trout there, you have a better chance with bigger bait.
I think the reason is that we throw smaller bait all the time, and we're going to catch a bigger trout sooner or later.
That's
all
what
the guys
I mean,
throwing corkies. The guys throwing corkies are throwing, what's a corky, 3.5 inches, something like that.
Bigger profile.
Most of the big trout in Texas are caught on that. You know, I mean, name another lure that's caught more big trout than a corky. It's kind of hard to do. But if I think the problem with the big bait, big fish, is that you can't throw a big bait for very long. I've done it. I've gone out there with the idea of, man, I'm going to try this, and I'm going to throw this big old swim bait and throw one of those 8-9-inch long swim baits. Back when I was in the lure industry, one of the companies I worked with had some of those big ones. It'll wear your ass out. I mean, you throw that thing for about an hour, and all of a sudden it's like, man, I really don't want to throw this anymore.
Yeah. I want to troll.
Tiring.
Yeah. I want to drift.
What seemed like a really good idea when I tied it on this morning is starting to seem like not such a good idea anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it would work. If you could stick with it and fish in a big fish area and throw one of those gigantic swim baits like they do for bass, I think it would work. And like Dean said, eliminate a lot of the small bites.
And as Dean just said on the text board here, as we record live, the debate will never end. All right, we're getting into some fun ones here. It's a, and starting with you, Scott, it's a bite, not an eat. People say, I got an eat or I got a bite. It's a bite, not an eat.
From a sight fishing standpoint, I like to say he ate it. because I'm watching the lure. I'm watching the fly, and I'm standing up there on the back, you know, on my pulling platform, or I'm standing up there on my console and I'm watching the tarpon, and somebody's got a lure in front of it. My initial thing is going to be, he ate it. You know, it's easier to say that quickly, and people get the hint that, you know, you need to set the damn hook. But yeah, they're interchangeable. Yeah.
No, you'll hear eat. I know Gene says eat too. I always say bite.
So whenever if I miss the fish, I always say I had a bite. And it's funny because I never really put any thought into this terminology.
Now you know.
Until we got it. But if we're fishing and you're watching that top water, and when it gets hit, I'm always like, ooh, they ate it. Yeah. But if I miss them, it was a bite. So I don't know if that's just something in the subconscious that surfaces.
You're reassuring yourself.
Yes, yes, yes. It's it's an emotional thing for me.
Hey, we got two good ones. When we're tarpon fishing, when we're blind casting for tarpon, and I'll have somebody tell me, oh, I felt a nibble. No, you didn't. there is no such thing as a nibble.
There's a little bit of a nibble. It was a small bite. See, it was a bite. We got some really good ones here coming up in just a second.
Don't go anywhere. This is the Bite Me Fishing Show on Sports Radio 610. Welcome back to the Bite Me Fishing Show, talking things that are fact or fiction with the fellas here.
All right, here we go. They're not, quote, they're not going to eat lures right now. And that is a Dean special right there. When you hear they're not going to eat lures right now, is that fact or fiction?
That is fiction. Because they will eat lures. They'll eat lures days when they won't eat bait. So, I mean, I go toe-to-toe with the bait guys every day. And it's always fun to compare notes on how that works out. But as in many scenarios in this game that we play out there, there is a lot of variables. You know, it's where you are at that day. If you happen to cross paths with the right school of fish, you're going to get a better reaction. But no, I feel like I can do as well as anybody with lures on any day, compared to bait, live bait, dead bait.
Yeah.
Well, that part's true the way Dean set it up. I do know that there are times they just ain't eating anything. They're not going to eat lure. They ain't going to eat. They're just not eating.
Yeah, but the connotation is, the implication is that they're not going to eat lures right now, so I'm throwing bait and I'll catch them. And I don't think that's true.
Nope. No, that's not
right?
true. If they'll eat bait, they'll eat lures. But yeah, there are times when, like, the day after, for about 12 to 24 hours after one of those big dumps, you can sit there and look at the fish and put anything you want to in front of that fish, and he's just going to burp so loud that it pushes it out of the way. I mean, they're absolutely stuffed full, and they will not eat. I have done it, I don't know how many times, where I just insisted on going the day after a dump for some damn reason. And just, it's basically a sightseeing tour. You get to go look at a bunch of fish. You ain't going to catch them.
And Justin said it here. I think that's a justification. He said that's something that lazy people say, that people want, that want to fish with baits. They'll say, oh, they're not eating lures right now. We got to throw baits. I totally agree with that, Justin. All right, here's one. And I got a little story after I ask you, and we're starting with Scott. Trout eat croaker because croaker eat trout eggs.
False.
Fact or fiction? That's fiction. Is fiction. Let me tell you the story real quick. I used to believe this. I always used to believe this. I don't know who told me way back when. The thing about this, Dean, trout aren't even around their eggs after they, what do they call it, spewing or whatever it is. They're gone. They're long gone. Those eggs are just kind of floating around, you know. It's like trout eat croaker because croaker eat their eggs.
Spewing?
I think, isn't that what they call it, spewing? Yeah. Or maybe that was me on a really rough night. I was spewing.
You lost me after spewing.
Okay, now I'm gonna have to look it up. What is it called? I'm looking it up. Continue as I look this up. But that is fiction, correct, Dean?
Yes. they eat croaker because the majority of the diet of a speckled trout is fin fish. They eat, mm-hmm. they prefer to eat fish opposed to scavenging on the bottom the way redfish will. Redfish are a much more opportunistic feeder. They will eat a lot of dead things, and speckled trout eat more fin fish. And and because they spew their
juice. Looked it up. Y'all can laugh all you want.
They spew all you want. Croaker
Justin
gravy.
Says, I love fishing the spew. Talk to a scientist, because I just Googled it as we're talking. When they spawn and they actually lay the eggs, it's called spewing.
Well, that makes sense. I mean, yeah. I agree with that. It's
just... I mean, I've seen it on Discovery Channel, and that's the best way to describe it.
But the bottom line is, trout are like bass or sunfish. They don't have a nest that they sit there and protect. In fact,
exactly.
I can't think of any saltwater fish that do that, that nest. You know, maybe some of the tropical species.
I'm sure there's some, but I can't think of any.
Yeah, I can't think of any off the top of my head. And trout don't care. You know, they'll eat another trout. They'll eat whatever.
Fish are pushed to the windward shoreline.
I wouldn't know, because I don't go fish over there. No, I would say that.
I want to keep it simple and easy.
I would say that's false. I mean, fish aren't pushed by the currents. They're strong enough to swim against those things. Some bait fish and such, you know, there's a lot of theories that bait get pushed up against windy shorelines, and then the bigger fish will follow them there. But yeah. I mean, I don't know how much I buy into that theory, because they live their whole life in current. They live in...
They're strong.
That I don't see that overpowering their ability to escape or go wherever they want to. So, I don't see them getting pushed against their will into any area.
The water is pushed to the windward shoreline. The bait is pushed to the windward shoreline, but fish are drawn to the windward shoreline by the water and the bait, right?
And that more than likely makes sense. It's plausible.
Mm-hmm. I feel like the bait is drawn to the shoreline, because
even the bait
feeds. Right. The bait's feeding on plankton. You know, the start of the feeding is
the food chain.
Bottom of the food chain. The bottom of the food chain can't swim against the wind and can't swim against the current. So yes, the bottom of the food chain is getting pushed into those coves and the windward shorelines. So that makes sense that the bait will be there. And if the bait's there, the big fish will be there. They're not being affected directly by the wind and the waves and all that. I can tell you, when we fish those tournaments. And I was fishing redfish terms. I fished a whole lot of windy coves. It's a pain in the butt to fish. I don't like to do it, and it's not fun. But that's where a lot of the bigger fish that we found during tournament time would be sitting in a cove with the wind blowing into it. And
right,
I think it's just because the food chain gets started there and gets shoved up in there, and it kind of concentrates everything.
And then the fish are drawn there. All right, a couple more here, and then we're going to get to maybe a snook pattern, and what would Scott do? What would Caleb do? This is a Scott starting this one. Trout only spawn in the spring and the fall.
Nope. Trout will spawn all summer long. Depends on their size.
All year long.
Year long. The bigger trout, they're going to spawn heavier in the spring, but You can clean a female trout anytime and find eggs in them.
Yeah. You know, Dean, on this one, I was reading a question, an old question. That's where I came up with the idea. And the question was about, it was more of a comment, talked about how he caught a big trout, but it was skinny. And so it must have been spawned out. And so I was like, I don't know how much. I mean, yeah, they lose some weight when they spawn. but the fish is either going to have its profile or not. It's either going to be big or not. I mean, a lot of times the spawn doesn't necessarily make a fish skinny. And that's where this question came from, that they only spawn in the spring and the fall.
Whether it's the spawn that makes them, I mean, I tend to find skinnier trout, especially in the summertime. They're just, they don't eat as often and they don't eat as much. So a fish is a cold-blooded creature. Their body is dictated by the temperature of the water. The ability to metabolize food is limited in extremely hot water. So they just don't eat as much and they just don't eat as often. They will lose weight in the summertime.
It's interesting though, because you would think it would be the other way around. More sluggish, you know, that type thing in the colder water.
I'm not a fisheries biologist, but I know people who have actually performed some really weird studies in the laboratory on fish, on their temperatures and their behaviors that react to those temperatures. And they actually will, their organs and their internal functions, they physiologically have to change functions in their body to metabolize food during water temperature changes. And, you know, that's a whole long topic that we can get into someday. But when the water temperature changes, their body actually goes through a physiological change that allows them to metabolize food, just like a lizard or a snake, a frog. It's a cold-blooded creature. And the water, the temperature of their environment affects their feeding appetite. So you will find skinnier trout in the summer. And of course, there's somebody that's going to break that rule somewhere.
Sure.
And find them a nice thick trout and go, oh, Dean don't know what he's talking about, which I can't disagree with that either.
Which, okay, when you're right, you're right. But we're learning here. It's good stuff. Let's do one more of these when we come back. Plus, do snook pattern. That's next right here on the Bite Me Fishing Show. Welcome back, everyone. A reminder here to join the Bite Me Facebook group page. Just be sure to hit the I agree button when you do. And on that page, all kinds of cool stuff. First of all, a great community, great posts, questions, and you can hit us up with topics as well. You can also RSVP for the feeding frenzy on a post that's pinned to the top of the page, as is the link for the pre-frenzy raffle. With just $10 a ticket, you can win a fishing trip with Captain Dean the Friday before the August 29th frenzy. All right, here's the last one, fact or fiction. Dean, you're starting it. There's no difference between an angler and a fisherman. I have a theory on this. That's why I put this one in. Let me share my theory first, because you look confused.
You go first.
You look confused. No offense. Someone.
That's my normal look.
It's the state of confusion.
Someone who calls themselves an angler. They call themselves an angler because they buy expensive stuff and want to sound fancy. Like, we're all fishermen, but like the guys with all the little, you know, $800 shirts and the $200,000 bay boat and all that stuff. They call themselves an angler because they spent a lot of money and they want to sound fancy. An angler is a fisherman, but we're all fishermen.
Yeah. The guy that wears his fishing shirt to church on Sunday is an angler. And the guy who goes out in his favorite raggedy t-shirt is a fisherman out there on the water. I don't know. I guess it's like bite or eat. They're kind of it's kind of interchangeable.
But an angler just wants to be like, he wants to be snooty. He wants to be like, I got good stuff.
Yeah. That's why, you know, you have, oh shit, I'm going to hurt some feelings again. Fly fishermen are people who go with the fly.
Look what John just messaged. Fly fishermen call themselves angler.
He beat me to it.
100%. 100%.
Yeah,
I'm a fly angler. See, Scott's not saying much right now. Scott's an angler. Nah. Scott calls himself an angler.
It's go ahead, Scott. Fisherman. I mean, if the definition comes with buying a lot of expensive stuff, that's all of us.
Well, yeah, but yeah. You know, the fancy schmancy.
Yeah, you're pretty fancy.
I try to hide it with my dirty fishing shirts. The word of the day is spew, Marcus. That is the word of the day is spew.
I'm gonna work that into my vocabulary.
Ask Delaney. Well, Delaney already had an issue with her talk about the honey hole. She already had an issue with the honey hole discussion. About the general?
She
sold.
She spent about 8 or 9 hours on the general yesterday. Yeah.
Oh wow. Well, do tell.
Yeah, had her and her husband out there, and he just continued on and on about it. He talked about it quite a bit. So Delaney, get ready, because I think the baby cat's going to go up for sale, and y'all going to end up with a general.
This question has been on the rundown. All right, so you two guys have caught a lot of snook. I catch them by accident. I've caught them by accident a couple of times, but that's about it. So the question is a very simple one. We'll get to that. Do snook pattern like other fish? And I actually lost the question somewhere in the mix, but that's basically what he was asking, because it seems like snook are more plentiful now than they've been in a while. And they want to know, do they pattern? Scott?
Their pattern is structure for the most part. And it varies from place to place a little bit, but most of the snook I've caught have been tight to some kind of structure. They're not really so much. I say that my biggest snook was out now, middle of open water, but for the most part, they're going to be structure oriented. Cast up as tight as you can to whatever structure you got. And yes, we do have a lot more of them now. After the big freeze a couple years ago, there was one guy picked up six that were 28 and up around Port O'Connor somewhere. Nobody could say where. Nope. And nobody really seems to know. I have my suspicions about where he was, but there was another one that floated up on the beach at Sunday Beach in the middle of the pass that was like 32 inches. And I've told on here, I saw one at the jetties that I guarantee you was 35 to 40 inches long about 2 or 3 years ago. So, yes, there's more snook here than we realize. I just think people don't throw tight enough to the structure to pull them out. And we don't target them. Down south, they do. Yeah, mm-hmm. I've got one that I caught down there. It was over 30 in the Brownsville Ship Channel. And that was my goal. I wanted a 30-inch snook from Texas. I've caught them over in Florida and Belize up 35, 36 inches. But I wanted a big Texas snook, and I got it.
Dean, what Scott just referenced there was going to be my thought here, so I want you to elaborate because you're better at it. They get under stuff. They not only get tight to stuff, they get under stuff. So you really have to get in there.
And if you go down south, or if you go to Florida where you have numbers of them, you can probably pattern them better. You know, if you have like a population that lives their whole life there, the snook that we have here are mainly migrants. So in the marina right there where your boat is parked now after the big freeze, we picked up numerous tarpon and snook that were dead in that marina. And I mean, it's not uncommon for them to get caught randomly around those areas throughout the summer. But if you want to catch a snook, if you want to go catch one today, you go to the Port Aransas jetties, and it's a lot easier to do walking on the rocks than from the boat. So you walk down the jetties and you bump a jig right there along the edges of the rocks, and they can consistently be caught if you target them. I mean, I've hooked into a snook right here at the Port A jetties in the 30-inch range, and which is the common snook. The fat snook are even more plentiful, which are much smaller. But, I mean, they do live there throughout the heat of the summer. But supposedly those are migratory fish that when it gets cold, they are going to migrate back down the coast. So if you go to an area where they live year round, that's probably an easier question to answer on patterning them from day to day basis, you know, like the Everglades and such as that. But just like Scott said, they are on the rocks, in the rocks. They're always going to be hanging up really close to something. It's kind of territorial. They're more of a, when I think of them, it's like a bass, you know, they will pick an area and they will defend it and stake it out where they're not really roaming around like redfish will.
And I know listeners are going to ask this, what are you throwing? Same?
A white worm.
Also known as a soft plastic.
I knew I'd get a chuckle. But yeah. So the snook that I've caught out there on the jetties has always been with a small white, like a rat tail, a smaller version of the rat tail jig.
All right. Coming up in hour two, let's get to some of your questions. Plus, we're going to have hunting season never ends, and it's one you definitely want to hear. The very invasive, very perilous New World screw worm has begun to invade Texas. We'll talk about what it means with one of the best hunting experts around next.